Hello and welcome to the One Stop English podcast for May 2017. Each month we bring together teachers, editors and experts to discuss what's going on in the world of ELT. I'm your host Sam Wadsworth, former teacher and current editor here at Macmillan. Joining me this month are Patrick Curry, Delta Qualified Teacher and editor on One Stop English.
Hi Sam.
Lizzie Reed, editor and Delta Qualified Teacher, currently studying for a Master's in Applied Linguistics.
Hi Sam.
And Luke Roger, Delta Qualified EAP Teacher, currently studying for a Master's in Applied Linguistics.
Hello there.
This month we'll be discussing English as a lingua franca, co-teaching and effective filters. We also have an interview with Scott Thornbury, teacher, teacher trainer, ELT academic and author of numerous best-selling methodology books. All right, let's get started. Lizzie, what's ELF and why do we need to know about it?
ELF stands for English as a lingua franca, and it's very important nowadays. Lots of students are no longer learning English to integrate into society in Britain or America. They're using it to communicate in an international context, and that's what we describe English as a lingua franca as, communication between people who do not share the same first language.
Right.
For anybody teaching multilingual classes, think of those moments just before your class or in the break when you may be in the classroom but you're not teaching. Your students are happily chatting away to each other in English. You hear all sorts of so-called errors, but communication between students does not break down for one single second. Someone uses an uncountable noun in a plural form, hang on, the world didn't end. Everyone understands each other perfectly. Yet, despite occasions like this, and they are frequent occasions, there still seems to be a huge focus on correctness and accuracy in the classroom.
So if we're not going to focus on correctness and accuracy, what should we be focusing on as teachers?
I think in the classroom we need to move away from this idea of correct and get closer to what is communication. Are people communicating effectively? Can they get their message across?
Okay.
A lot of ELF work is based on work that was originally done by Jennifer Jenkins, a linguist at Southampton University. And the work was empirically based originally around studies of non-native speakers communicating to each other. And she just recorded them communicating and noted where communication broke down. And she found that, for example, the TH sound, when people mispronounce this in various ways, you know, French speakers typically might say, I sink, for a British person would say, I think. And she found, in fact, that this didn't cause any real problems with communication. I mean, in terms of classroom implications, obviously it means that all the happy hours that we spend with our students, you know, teaching them to put your tongue in, lifting your teeth and your finger on your nose and touch it. All that isn't very useful for students who aren't going to be communicating with native speakers. If they just want to operate internationally, perhaps in a business context, they don't actually need that. She did find that most consonant sounds are important for communication, and she developed something called the English as a lingua franca core, which is a set of kind of core features that students do need communicatively.
I think that's an interesting point, that we've got this core that we can work from, but otherwise English as a lingua franca is quite difficult to put into a syllabus of sorts. So I think it remains to be seen what will happen in the future. One thing's for sure, as native speakers, we are definitely in the minority now of people using English. So let's wait and see what happens as things continue.
Okay, thanks, Lizzie. Patrick, I understand that in the world of teaching, two heads might well be better than one.
Right, yeah, possibly. This is something I looked into this month, which was to do with co-teaching, which is a practice that emerged back in the 70s in the USA. And it was mainly to address the issue of disabled students in inclusive classrooms, which is nowadays is termed SEN, so special educational needs. Traditionally, it involves a collaboration between a general teacher and a special educational needs teacher. And the teachers would share the planning, teaching and assessment of the class, and both of them responsible for the instruction and education and leadership within the class. So more recently, it's been used with monolingual primary and young learner classes overseas, where there might be more classroom management issues. Though this practice is often less of a co-teacher model and more of a classroom assistant role. But what I want to talk about today with you guys is, what are the advantages of co-teaching?
I mean, the biggest one for me is clearly they get more time with the teacher, right? There's more teacher to go around, so they get more one-on-one time.
I think that's true in another way as well. When you've got large classes, you want to do fun activities, often groups, you've got more chance to kind of monitor effectively.
That's true.
There's more people in the classroom.
Yeah. I mean, I think as you say about if there are different levels in the class, you know, the possibility of one teacher offering particular support perhaps to a small group while the other teacher focuses on the rest of the class.
And actually, that's sort of made me think of an interesting idea. You could have one teacher that was a specialist in something, like pronunciation, and another teacher is a specialist in something else, and they could work together to complement each other.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it could be used when you've got new teachers and experienced teachers. So someone just new to the industry and they come to school and one of their colleagues has had, you know, years of experience, they could then kind of mentor them.
Sort of shadow them.
Yes, that kind of thing. Mm. And maybe professional development as well. I mean, it's good for great for observations. So, you know,
absolutely.
Often you only see yourself teaching, you're only, you know, aware of, you're not really aware of your mistakes, you know?
I think off the back of that as well is the pre-stage before you get into the classroom that you've got someone to plan with or throw ideas around with to bring something new to the classroom.
Yeah, so I guess in an ideal situation, it brings out the strengths of both teachers. But could there be any drawbacks to this?
Well, actually, that the planning thing probably links to a weakness in a way, is that it surely requires a lot more planning. You need to plan when each teacher will intervene or what they will do or what their role is. And does one teacher take more of the lead? Is one the leader and the other sort of there to facilitate activities and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly been my experience with co-teaching when it hasn't been sufficiently planned on the few occasions I have done it, and we've ended up perhaps going in directions that the other teacher doesn't expect. You find yourself in strange places in lessons where you're not quite sure what you're doing necessarily.
Yeah, if you have someone taking a subordinate role as well, there could be resentment on both sides, definitely.
And I mean, this might sound a bit strange, but from the point of view of the institution, do they now have to pay two teachers for one class? It's not a very practical solution. Do they get paid half because they're doing a class together?
Yeah, no, the practicalities are quite interesting. I thought also maybe it could create divisions within the class if students favour one teacher over another. It could be an issue. And I suppose ultimately there's got to be a good reason for bringing in this model, and there's no actual long-term studies, no data that shows that classes which are co-taught outperform classes which are not co-taught. So, I think it's more at the moment the case of using it for special educational needs. But a couple of things I wanted to discuss on this point with you guys. Luke, you mentioned you've co-taught and it wasn't particularly successful. Sam, Lizzie, have you guys ever co-taught?
I've never co-taught. I mean, the planning thing is something that relates to just sharing a class. I've shared classes with other teachers. You know, I teach on certain days and they teach on other days. And that's difficult enough to plan sometimes. I've been in the classroom in observations, and when students know that there's someone else in the room, they often ask questions to different people, they get different answers. Sometimes it can cause difficulties if you don't have that one kind of channel of information.
Yeah, it definitely would depend on the dynamic within the classroom. The teacher would have to be very experienced and probably they'd have to work together for quite a long time for that dynamic to kind of become more fluid.
Yeah, and I worked in Vietnam for a bit and had lots of really, really amazing teaching assistants. And actually, you know, it makes me think I wish I'd taken better advantage of those guys and really brought them into the planning and got them more involved in the actual activities rather than just, I mean, largely they were taking registers and, you know, controlling the kids and, you know, monitoring them during break time, that kind of thing. But actually, I could have used them to much greater effect, I think.
Yeah, I think there are benefits with certain types of classes like special educational needs. Very, very large classes as well. If you're in a public education, you know, 40, 50 students in the class, and maybe with very young learners for classroom management. But ultimately, yeah, I think it needs to be beneficial and you need to have the practicalities worked out before you actually make that leap.
Great. All right. Thanks very much. So listeners, what do you think? Is it time we stop measuring students by native speaker norms? Have you ever tried co-teaching? Email your comments to onestoppodcast@springernature.com. Now it's time for Warmer of the Month. Each month we challenge our guest teacher to explain a fun, communicative activity in no more than 5 steps. So Luke, over to you.
Okay, so it's quite a big warmer. It's called Ask the Expert. And in this activity, the teacher comes into the class and they tell the class that they're an expert in something and that today the class can ask them questions. So I teach in London at the moment, so I'd usually choose a topic like I'd say I'm an expert in London. Pairs of students in the class then think of one or two questions and you take a question from each pair. The teacher answers the questions and boards examples of open questions that might be useful for other students later to generate discussion. Things like, you know, what's the best museum in London? Where can I get good Italian food? How do people survive the weather? You know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And in the next stage, so students write down three topics that they're experts in. You make clear that, like the teacher, you know, I'm not an expert in London. They don't have to be real experts. They just have to know something about it. One student might have, you know, classical music, Paris and cars, for example. Then in groups of three, the students discuss together. They ask each other questions about their particular topics. And after around 10 minutes, you stop the discussion and groups feedback what they learned from their partners to the group. I particularly like this activity because it's a really good way of encouraging the students to be interested in each other. You know, they're often from different countries, different cultural backgrounds,
right, yeah.
And they can learn a lot from each other. And it generates a lot of vocabulary that students are usually very interested in because it's, you know, about things that they're passionate about and interested in.
It seems like a really good way to learn about their interests as well, if you want to sort of personalise the content to them, to personalise lessons.
Yes, definitely, yeah. It's a very good kind of start of the course activity.
I was going to say, it's something that you bring in at the very beginning of the course rather than right at the end of the course. So it's kind of getting to know you and your students. Well, they get to know you, you get to know them.
Okay, great. So are we going to have a go now? Are we going to play?
Yeah, okay. If we imagine that we're a class, the teacher would come in. None of you are from Yorkshire, are you?
No.
So I'm from Yorkshire. So, I'd say I'm an expert in Yorkshire. Today, you can ask questions and I'll try to answer. Do you have any questions about Yorkshire?
So what is Yorkshire famous for?
It's famous for tea, which is particularly good. Mm. Famous for cricket and beautiful countryside. Really, the Yorkshire Dales, lovely national park. What would you guys be experts in?
Patrick,
I'd probably go with something like cricket. I'm not necessarily a massive expert, but students would obviously be fascinated to learn about cricket.
Right, Lizzie.
If I were teaching here in the UK, then I could claim to be an expert in Munich, where I spent 7 years teaching before.
Right, and I am, this is true, an expert in retro video games. So listeners, send in your questions, please. Great, thanks very much, Luke. Let's move on. Okay, next up, it's Word of the Month. Each month, we discuss a piece of ELT jargon and how it affects teachers. So, Patrick, how are you feeling?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Do you want me to turn the lights down for this one? Maybe put on some music?
No, I think we're okay with the lighting as it is.
Okay, all right. Well, tell us about effective filters.
Yes, okay. So I guess you guys will probably remember that way back in podcast 3, we talked about Stephen Krashen's theory of comprehensible input. Well, Stephen is once again crashing the party because we're going to talk about his effective filter theory. So, effective filter, what is it? Very simply, it is a theoretical construct, a bit like an imaginary screen between students and the language. And the screen prevents learning, and it's affected by emotional variables. So this effective filter can be either high or low. When it is high, students experience stress, anxiety, and a lack of confidence that can severely inhibit their ability to acquire a second language. When the filter's low, students are more relaxed, comfortable and confident, and therefore more open to trying new things which will aid language learning. It's really important to be aware of students' effective filter when teaching learners who are more likely to be affected by emotional factors, so children or even prisoners, for example. And you should avoid behaviour that might be considered judgmental by learners because that would affect their learning. So, with you guys, I wanted to ask you what you think might create the high effective filter, which is the one which stops students being able to learn.
I think pressure has got to be number one. This is something for me that's not even connected to language learning, but as soon as I have to do anything vaguely mathematical, I feel that fear coming. And the classroom where you feel like you can't make a mistake and you just have that horrible pressure, it just blocks you entirely.
Right, so if you're a teacher and you're cracking down and shouting when people get things wrong, that's not going to help.
No.
Luke, what do you think?
I think you mentioned about not being judgmental. I think feeling that the teacher's there looking for errors or ready to pounce on errors. I think relating back to the English as a lingua franca thing, I think, which is a lot more communicatively focused, I think having an environment where people are genuinely interested in what people are saying rather than in standards of correctness, I think.
Right.
I think interest, as Luke just said, is one thing as well. I mean, if you're bored, then it's just horrific in the classroom. We need to pick situations that people are genuinely interested in.
Absolutely. And look, presumably the layout of the class has an effect on that as well. If you're sort of sat in a lecture style sitting, or you know, you're all sat around a table and it's quite uncomfortable, then that's not going to help your studies.
No, I think it's important to be aware of very basic things like body language. You know, a negative tone of voice, negative body language. Those kind of things get picked up on by more sensitive students. What about the opposite, going the other way? If you wanted to lower the effective filter, I mean, obviously the opposite of what we've just said, but are there any additional things that you could do to help students be more comfortable?
I think there are some fun things that you can do. People talk about starting your class with some music to get the right atmosphere flowing, or just how your classroom looks if there's nice bright things on the walls, and just making it a welcoming environment.
Yeah, Sam, you mentioned lighting just a few minutes ago, and so having good lighting for the students would be nice.
Exactly, yeah. Or just at least something that's conducive to study, an environment that makes it, you know, easier, makes them want to study. Luke, any ideas?
Yeah, and I think just being friendly as well, obviously, is very important. It's better to err on the side of, you know, being too smiley and seeming a bit simple than being, you know, sarcastic or cynical in the classroom. Certainly, I think you want to present a kind of positive, open attitude.
Definitely. And I think one more thing is task type. So making sure that the tasks are not horribly difficult for students so they are able to achieve them, but also making sure they're not kind of patronisingly easy so they think they're too simple and they're at the wrong level. So giving them kind of the right level of challenge, basically, so they feel like they can complete the task and they're achieving something in the class that lends itself to kind of lowering their effective filter, making them want to learn. And then, yeah, obviously error correction in terms of phrasing, I think, is important. You know, making sure that you're being constructive in your criticism rather than just pointing out, as you said, errors all the time.
No. No, wrong.
Very much so. Ultimately, as a teacher, I think it's not just your job to kind of impart the language to students, but you also need to provide that environment where students are best able to acquire the language. There's obviously no kind of hard and fast rule for this as the environment changes from class to class. But if you're able to ascertain how best to lower your students' effective filters and make your classroom environment open and welcoming, then you give your students a much better chance to learn.
All right. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Okay, let's move on to this month's interview. This month, Patrick is talking to Scott Thornbury about the new edition of the A to Z of ERT, how not to plan a grammar syllabus, and blended learning.
Okay, hi Scott, how are you?
Hi Patrick, I'm extremely well. I'm recovering from the iTEFL conference, which was full on as usual, but I'm back to work and I'm feeling good.
Where are you today? You're in Barcelona?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Nice and sunny over there, is it?
It's a beautiful day, I have to say.
Yeah. It's actually not too bad here in London. Okay, well, let's get stuck into things. And first off, I wanted to ask you about your blog, An A to Z of ELT, which has been going since 2006. And you've just released a new updated version of your book of the same title, A New A to Z of ELT. And the original book and the website are very, very popular. So I wanted to ask you about why you think that is.
Well, first of all, yeah, the blog was initiated basically to support the book and in anticipation of a second edition, basically. Because, I mean, as soon as the book was written, I realized things needed revisiting, new topics that were coming into view. I mean, the field is constantly in flux and changing, and it's a challenge to keep up with everything that's going on in all the different subfields, like linguistics, sociolinguistics, second language acquisition, and so on. So that was the incentive behind doing the blog. The blog sort of took on a life of its own because the wonderful thing about blogging is that it is so interactive.
Sure.
And so, you know, unlike writing a book, which takes a while and then it sits there and people buy it and maybe you run into people who've used it or read bits of it and you get some feedback, but the blog is almost instantaneous. It's a kind of ongoing conversation, and that in itself is very stimulating. And I learned an enormous amount, which has fed into the second edition. But I mean, in terms of keeping yourself abreast of things, I mean, it partly comes from blogging and from reading comments, from attending conferences like the iTEFL one, for example. And also, of course, I do my own teaching. I'm teaching on a master's program, so I'm constantly being challenged by my students on things that, you know, I have to go back to the books and look. I mean, just this morning, I had to think, what's the difference between reporting clauses and relative clauses that begin with that? So you're always learning in this business.
Sure.
And that's what the second edition, I think, reflects. It's what has happened, what I've learned in the last 10 years or so.
Mm. And with the blog, is there a rule you have at how often you update it, or is it just sort of as and when?
The blog, in fact, actually has gone quiet. I mean, I have bursts at it, and then I'll probably go quiet. And at the moment, I think I'm about to restart it again to coincide with the publication of the second edition. But basically, I find when I read other people's blogs, I like to know that there's something going to be new fairly regularly. So I made a policy of blogging every week when I was blogging, so people could expect a new post every, well, it happened to be Sunday morning, and then I could address the responses in the subsequent week.
Yeah, I mean, I think that helps well with teachers because they look for fresh stuff at the start of every week. So if they know it's going to be updated, it's something for them to look forward to and they can tap into for their teaching.
Exactly.
So yeah, you were at TEFL, and did you give a talk this year?
Yes, I gave a talk. It was a kind of promotional talk for the new edition. But what I'm interested in as a writer of methodology is the role that methodology writers have in mediating the sort of research and the classroom practice, because teachers clearly don't have time or even the inclination to wade through masses of research, studies, etc. So that's what I sort of do. And there's a number of people in the field, and I was interested as to how these people who write methodology books approach the challenge of mediation, and how do they keep abreast, and do they have an agenda and stuff like that. So that's what I was talking about.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So you obviously, you've given a lot of talks over your career. Is there one that really sticks out for you as the most memorable in terms of how it resonated with the audience, and did it cause a big ripple within the industry?
Well, I'm not the one to judge with the size of the ripple, whether it was a tsunami. I do remember the launch of the book I co-wrote with Luke Meddings for Delta Publishing called Teaching Unplugged, which was a kind of resume review of all the discussion that had been going on about dogma stroke Teacher Unplugged in the preceding 10 years. And we launched that at IATEFL in, I think it was Cardiff. We decided that we'd sort of do a dogma talk. So in other words, we wouldn't come in and do some presentation and then ask for questions. We'd start with the questions and then do the presentation. Well, the thing was amazing. It was absolutely packed. It was the end of the day. It was billed as a promotional thing, and that didn't deter people. And we did it exactly like that. We just said, well, are there any questions? And the questions came at us like cannon fire, and it was fantastically interactive. And there, of course, there was no time for the presentation, which we didn't have anyway, because we were sort of like assuming that we could run with the questions. Whether it created a ripple or not, I don't know. But there was certainly a lot of energy in the room.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very familiar with Teaching Unplugged. And yeah, I think a lot of teachers, it kind of revolutionized the way they approach classes. Not necessarily every day, but it was something that you'd take into your class once a week or so to challenge yourself and see how you could use the students as a resource, which, yeah,
exactly.
Very popular indeed. Great. So I want to talk about something you mentioned in a blog post a few years ago, which is about grammar syllabus. You said they're becoming less innovative and more derivative. Is that still true for you? And how would you like to see grammar covered?
Yes, I mean, I think it is true. It's true. And if you look at the contents page of any general English course book, you'll see that they're almost mirror images of each other in terms of the way that they carve up the grammar cake. I mean, you say, how would I like to see grammar covered? I think I would like to see it uncovered. And I think that's the point of Teaching Unplugged, is the idea of uncovering grammar, which is the title of a book, in fact, I wrote for Macmillan for the Teacher Development Series, that grammar is an emergent phenomenon over historical time, but also in the life of an individual, both in their first language and their second language, that we start off sort of teaching speaking fairly lexically, and then gradually we piece this together with grammar. The grammar comes through trying things out and getting feedback. And that's really what the dogma approach was really all about, not having a pre-selected syllabus, but let's see, having topics or tasks and then tidying it up for the learner through feedback, recasting, reformulation, whatever you want to call it, so they start to intuit what it is that's missing from their system. But we can't predict the way that the learner is going to acquire the grammar. Learners are individuals. They do it in different ways. You can't say today's Tuesday, therefore, you know, you're going to learn the present perfect continuous. We know, experienced teachers know, that this, of course, never happens. We teach it brilliantly, and the next week is out the window.
Yeah, so I suppose it's a case of natural exposure rather than kind of predetermined exposures.
I think natural and massive exposure, if possible, and that's why out-of-class learning is a good idea as well.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I mean, we talked about learner autonomy on an earlier pod, and it's something that we like to encourage and raise awareness of. But let's move on to, I want to ask your opinion on blended learning. There's a lot of talk around blended learning. I don't know whether it was a big thing at IATEFL this year, but do you think the future of ELT is in blended learning?
Well, I mean, I think that was one of the things I wanted to include in the new edition of the A to Z, that and the flipped classroom. These innovations in technology, which outstrip our ability to keep up with them, actually. And this is one of the challenges of writing methodology books. You know, when you get onto the subject of technology, educational technology, and educational technology, I think we have to embrace, but also be rather critical or skeptical. But we have to keep an open mind and not get caught up in this sort of hype that's often associated with innovations in this field. And I think there's a danger of overhyping blended learning, flipped classrooms, and all that kind of thing. As I said before, we need to maximize learners' exposure to language and use of language outside the classrooms, particularly if they're studying only 2 or 3 hours a week. I mean, that's, nobody's going to learn a language just doing that.
No, no.
So if blended learning means opportunities to use, read, listen to, write, speak language outside the classroom, then so much the better. And also, if it frees the classroom from some of the kind of more pedestrian things that happen in classrooms, like doing grammar exercises and that kind of thing, then great, do it outside the classroom. I mean, the way we've always done in the form of homework. But now we've got the technology to facilitate that, and therefore it has to be, it's great, I mean, but it needs to be used with discretion. And if students are just doing masses of grammar exercises and nothing more, and it's being called blended learning, then that seems to be self-defeating. And I know there's been studies recently which suggest that, in fact, learners are not all that crazy about blended learning. I read a study, I can't remember where, but said, was given a choice, that either have completely online learning or completely classroom learning, but they didn't like the blend of the two. So I think we have to be cautious, as in all things to do with educational technology.
Yeah, definitely. It's about being discerning about the use of it, obviously, but also about being aware what best helps out the students, definitely. So I wanted to ask you advice. You're a teacher educator as well as a teacher and an author, and I wanted to get some advice for teachers who are listening. First of all, what are your best three pieces of advice for someone who's just entering the profession, who's maybe just taken their initial qualification?
Well, I would say learn a second language if you haven't already, or learn a third or a fourth. Put yourself in the position of being a learner, because it really is salutary to realize how difficult often language learning is, particularly for adults. And it's going to do you good anyway. The more languages you learn, the more you understand about language generally. And I think related to that is become a grammar nerd. There's no end of interesting things to be learned about the grammar of English, not just the grammar, the phonology as well. I think that is one of the things that makes this profession really interesting. Even if we don't have to convey this information to the learners, but it's useful and helpful to know your grammar inside out. And I guess related to that too is, I would say, question everything. Don't take everything as face value. Whatever people tell you, challenge it. And if need be, follow something up. If you don't agree with what you've been told, for example, about when, how to correct learners' errors, then experiment and, you know, do things differently, read out how other people do it and so on. But don't take stuff lying down.
Be more proactive rather
than
passive, yeah. And then let's look at the other end of the scale, the teachers who've been in the industry for many years, who might be a little bit kind of staid. Do you have any advice for veteran teachers?
Well, being a veteran teacher myself, I mean, I guess experiment again. I mean, teach unplugged if you've not taught unplugged before. Go into a class and just work from what comes up from the get-go. That can be very revealing to realize what resources are available both within yourself as a human being, as a social animal. You're not going to just stand there saying nothing. And what the resources that are available within a class, even a low-level class, have an amazing capacity to piece together a text, for example, to create a text out of their own shared language knowledge. So that would be one thing. I think getting any kind of feedback on your I think we get a bit nervous. Even some of the longer that we teach, we get more and more nervous about people coming and watching us. But I mean, you don't have to have people observing you. But I think a lot of teachers work in isolation nowadays, particularly those who teach online, those who teach one-to-one for businesses, etc. But getting some kind of feedback. And feedback from the learners, if nothing else. I mean, don't be afraid of asking the learners, you know, what did you like about that lesson? What weren't you so keen on? And that kind of thing. And I think the third piece of advice, I just say, is like count something. Count the number of times that the learners produce full sentences. Count the number of times you say, good, okay, right. Count the number of times. I mean, you learn a lot simply by that very, very basic form of classroom research. It's quantifying your contributions and the students' contributions to the ongoing lesson.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to chat. It's been fascinating, very, very interesting indeed.
Thank you, Patrick. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, and best of luck with the new A to Z of ELT. I'm sure it will be an absolute winner.
I hope so.
For sure. And enjoy the rest of the summer sun in Barcelona.
I will indeed. All right.
Cheers.
Okay.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, next up is a new section called Teacher Tips. Each month, we ask our guest teacher for their top three tips. So, Luke, what advice have you got?
Okay, so Scott Thornbury talked a bit in the interview there about teaching unplugged. So I thought I'd give some tips relating to generating discussion, which was something I didn't always feel confident with at the start of my teaching career. My first tip would be avoid overcorrection. When I started off doing discussion-based activities, freer activities where the students took more control, initially I would veer between excessive correction and trying to control it, or letting everything go and feeling guilty because no one was actually learning anything.
Right.
But I think just being aware, you know, if you've got a particular language focus in that lesson, correct for that, and anything else, pick up later. You know, you want the discussion to be a success in the class at the time.
That's a good tip, yeah.
The second tip relates to something Adrian Underhill, who I believe was on last month's podcast,
that's right, yeah,
said, which is about kind of opening up space for discussion when you're doing feedback. So as teachers, you know, we're feeding back answers all the time to exercises. And I think rather than just hearing a correct answer and going good, or hearing an incorrect answer and saying no, you can, when you hear, even when you hear a correct answer, you can ask, do you agree to the class? Because I mean, at the point when they give the correct answer, everybody's listening. That's the point in the lesson when they're actually curious to hear what you've got to say. So you can say, well, do you agree? Okay, why? And if there is disagreement, okay, who's right? Can you justify why? And then you can put them back into pairs and get them to explain why. Or if someone gives an answer that's not right, be interested in it rather than...
Just like, why did you think that? What made you think that? And we can talk about why it's not right.
Yes. It also generates more discussion as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Third point, just take an interest in learners' language. This idea of learners making mistakes. As teachers, you can probably get frustrated by all these mistakes. But I think, as Scott was saying, you know, language, there's a huge variety of language that students are using. And it's very interesting the ways that students use the language. I think rather than regarding these as mistakes, we can use these as ways of seeing how Spanish works applied to English, or how various different languages work. And regarding that as a way of learning and of how that relates to standard British English that they might be trying to learn.
Works. Absolutely. All right. Thank you. Good tips. All right. It's Q&A time on the One Stop podcast, the part of the show in which we try to answer your questions. So is everyone ready?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. First question this month. How should I react sensitively to confrontations between students in class? Luke is our guest teacher. You should probably go first.
Well, I mean, I think I'm quite fortunate in that I mostly teach adults, so we don't have a huge number of confrontations, as you might have perhaps in a secondary context. I think where I have had confrontations, I'd say maybe there should be some kind of Hippocratic teacher's oath, don't make anything worse, just be calm. I like, if there is a confrontation between students, to take a student aside and have a chat with them and try to understand why it's happened. And generally, yeah, outside of the class, I think.
Has anyone, if you've had a confrontation, have you tried to turn it into a teaching point? Find out what the issue is and then change your lesson plan entirely and make the lesson about that issue?
I haven't, but it's an interesting idea. I don't know if it would antagonize the situation.
I've never tried it.
It's a risk. It's a risk.
It is a risk. Okay, next question. How can I help students who don't seem to grow out of the so-called intermediate plateau?
I think it's quite a difficult case, this, actually, because intermediate plateau affects a lot of people. And it's interesting from the question point of view, because it's very much focused on the teacher. But I think in this situation, a lot needs to happen collaboratively between teacher and learner, and to try and sit down with them, maybe make a plan, and make them more aware of what they can do to promote their own learning.
Right, so learner autonomy that we were talking about recently on
absolutely.
The show. So just having them take more control over their learning and what they want to achieve.
Yeah, I think this is to do with possibly identifying objectives and goals and then focusing in on what can help them achieve those more. And then record keeping is important as well. Luke, do you have students at this level at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I agree completely with what's been said. I mean, to move from kind of B1 to, you know, the typical IELTS 6.5 or something, that's a very common cut target, it's hundreds and hundreds of hours of learning. So I think they need to have proximal targets that they can move towards to keep them motivated.
Absolutely. Okay, and finally this month, which grammar points do you either love or hate teaching? So maybe we should go around the table. Luke, what do you think?
I like comparatives because it's very communicative and they can compare lots of different things. I really hate relative clauses because it always gives me a headache. Defining and non-defining.
It's definitely a confusing area, right? Izzy?
I agree with what Luke said there about relative clauses. But for me, maybe I would choose something that I both love and hate, which is maybe present perfect continuous, that area of grammar. Hate it because it's really conceptually difficult sometimes, and love it because when they get it and they love it.
Right.
I'm going to agree with Luke, actually. I think the relative clauses can be a real pain to teach. Things I really love teaching, I don't know, I kind of will and going to. It was always kind of good for me. Just looking at future plans, seeing what people want to do in the future, what will be doing in the future, are going to do rather.
and for me, I'm not really sure about what I hated teaching, but I did love teaching present perfect. I think there's just such mileage in it. There's so many different facets to it. You know, there's sort of three big areas and things, and there's so much you can do with it. And it's such a useful area of language, especially the classic life experience. And then when you start to mix in past simple with it, you could just get some really good discussions going, I think.
Yeah, there's a grammarian that gave a lovely metaphor for the present perfect. It was like, it's like trying to put a balloon in your pocket. No matter how you do it, it's always going to be a bit poking out with any grammatical description.
I think that's a pretty good description, yeah. Well, that's all we've got time for this month. If you have any questions, suggestions or feedback, please email us at onestoppodcast@springernature.com or leave a comment on the One Stop page. Thank you to our in-house panellists this month, Patrick and Lizzie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to our guest teacher, Luke Roger. It's been a real pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening. And until next month, this is the One Stop English Podcast.